The recent publication of an international overview of clinical trials demonstrating a survival difference based on adequacy of local tumor control of breast cancer has increased interest in clinical situations with varying rates of local recurrence. I met with breast cancer surgeon Dr. Pat Borgen to discuss these and other issues in local therapy, and he began by commenting on the quality of margin assessment.
Margins always come into play with either invasive or in situ breast cancer. And there's ongoing work at our place with the role of MRI, looking at whether we can design our operative field smarter by doing preoperative MRIs. It's a problem because it's an expensive technology. It's a technology that not everyone has access to. And it can see phantoms. There's a reasonably high false positive rate associated with it. But nationally, and we fall into this group, re-excision rates for people who do pay attention to margins approach 50%. Almost half of our patients are going back for more surgery. So we need a smarter way to do that. I think the second scenario where there's a little bit of concern is in national trials of partial breast radiation therapy. The PETO meta-analysis raises the bar on the value of local control. I'm not a naysayer. In fact, we are participating in the NSABP B39 trial. But it is a cautionary note that whole breast radiation now has an established track record in a meta-analysis with proven deleterious effects in patients who did not receive whole breast radiation. So it's just a cautionary note.
Can you talk a little bit more about, you know, how you assess margins and make decisions about whether to re-excise?
We've recently changed our approach to margins. In the past, we did a lumpectomy, either by palpation or by image guidance with a wire, and oriented that specimen in space with silk sutures. The pathologists then applied 6 different colors of ink to the mass that we removed. And we found that this was not accurate enough, that the definition of what was anterior and what was superior was really left to the hands of a pathologist who wasn't there and didn't really know. So today what we're doing is doing a lumpectomy, a reasonable lumpectomy, and then right then and there, intraoperatively, shaving the margins individually. So I know that what I'm sending to the pathologist is superior, is medial, is inferior. We place a silk suture on the new margin, on the shave. This has been very successful. We've dropped our re-excision rate, we've dropped our positive margin rate, and when we've had to go back for a positive margin, we've been much more successful in finding more residual cancer.
You mentioned the trial of PBI. Do you think that trial is adequately powered to address this situation?
Well, it's adequately powered if we're willing to wait 12 years. And based on the statistically calculated number of events that would result in unblinding the trial, at expected rates of recurrence, it's 11 and a half years from now. So will it answer the question? Yes. Will we be patient enough to wait for an answer? I'm not sure. A number of leaders in the field, such as Varanasi, have been calling for smarter methods of investigational study, that the old days of randomizing every question to A versus B versus C and then waiting a decade are becoming harder and harder to accept. I think the sentinel node story is a classic example of this, where with sentinel node biopsy in breast cancer, you had a built-in control. You could do a sentinel node and then dissect the axilla, and in 20 cases or 100 cases, get your own sensitivity and specificity and validate or not validate the technique in your own hands. And yet there were those who cried for randomized trials. We don't know anything unless we do a randomized trial. So here we were, having done 4,000 sentinel node procedures while the NSABP was completing its randomized trial. And so that the pace of discovery has to quicken. In terms of partial breast radiation, we know what the long-term effectiveness of radiation therapy is. We know that in tens of thousands of patients. So would it be reasonable to consider a prospective series where a particular type of partial breast radiation was simply given and compared to historical controls? I would argue yes, that would be completely reasonable. I don't think we can look at our patients and say, I'll get you the answer in 11 years. I just don't think that's reasonable anymore.
What kinds of PBI techniques are you using right now at Memorial?
We are participating in the NSABP B39 trial using the conformal 3D external beam radiation therapy. We are not using the mammocyte technology, and we are not using the brachycatheters. We have a second parallel study that we're enthusiastic about using a high dose rate intraoperative applicator called a HAM applicator, where we are doing the lumpectomy, the sentinel node, and a single fraction of radiation therapy all in one setting.
Is this the Mike Baum thing?
This is identical to the Mike Baum thing, except ours is a much higher dose of radiation therapy. Mike's target trial provides about 10% of the dose that we are giving with our intraoperative high dose rate afterloader.
How many patients have you done so far?
We've done just over 100, and these have been in carefully selected over the age of 70 patients with invasive ductal cancers, unifocal, less than 1.5 centimeters. In other words, a group that is at relatively low risk for recurrence. And we've been very pleased with the patient acceptance. There's been some concern about how much fibrosis, one fraction of radiation, will cost the patient. And we've been extremely pleased with the cosmetic results, and it's also less expensive to the patient.
How much follow-up do you have at this point?
Well, we started the first case about 5 years ago, so we're coming up on 2.5 or 3 years of median follow-up. And we will not have nearly the ability to talk about local control unless it's horrifically bad. So this is really a phase one study. We did not have enough data to include it as a fourth arm to the NSABP B39 study, but we hope to, in the future, expand it. There are about 7 centers now who have an interest in this. In terms of the technology, this is a high dose rate afterloader that every hospital in the world has. So for developing nations, for example, who may not be able to afford a $4 million linear accelerator, this machine's about $100,000. So if we can document the safety of it, and if the concept of partial breast is validated across all the studies that are going on, this may be an attractive alternative.
You mentioned that you're not utilizing the mammocyte or brachytherapy as part of the trial. Why not?
Different reasons. We are not currently well positioned for the multi-brachycatheter setup. This is a very specialized technique. And in fact, in the NSABP trial, there are 500 investigators that are sort of credentialed for the trial, and fewer than 50 are actually credentialed for the brachycatheters. With the second technology, mammocyte, we've been long-term believers in what Mel Silverstein has called an oncoplastic approach to breast surgery, where you create a defect and then anatomically repair it. And I think Mel's right about that. The mammocyte balloon leaves a relatively large cavity that you are unable to close in the breast, and so we've had some concerns about long-term cosmesis. And thirdly, we have a very sophisticated physics department who has been able to do the 3D conformal partial breast on the fly, and we thought that we would be the best at that technology.
Now, are you utilizing this strategy off protocol?
No, we are only doing partial breast on either the single fraction high dose rate intraoperative radiation therapy or offering randomization on NSABP study.
Going back to local control, what about the issue of surgery without radiation therapy for the small node negative infiltrating tumors, elderly patients?
I think we were all struck by the results of the CALGB study that Kevin Hughes published in the New England Journal 6 months ago that showed in the population of women over the age of 70 with small unifocal cancers, there was no difference in survival in the radiated versus non-radiated group. And in fact, there was no difference in mastectomy rates because the majority of people who had a recurrence had a second lumpectomy. We have not used that data at this point as a wholesale endorsement of not radiating patients over 70. Remember that women who arrive at the age of 70 well have a 14-year life expectancy. And so we are very cautious about undertreating them as a policy. Where this trial plays a role in our practice is the woman who may have other medical conditions wherein the competing causes of death might be high enough that we can justify not treating with radiation therapy and reassure the patient that there's data on the safety of that. So I see the Hughes data as a floor, not a ceiling.
What about not radiating DCIS?
I certainly fall somewhere between the Mel Silverstein approach of minimally radiating people and the Bernie Fisher approach of radiating everyone with DCIS. And I like the fact that there's still a room for judgment. So in our practice, older patients with small areas of DCIS with wide margins might consider not radiating. Younger patients with incidentally discovered DCIS, you take out a fibroadenoma and there's 2 millimeters of DCIS, not in a big field of atypical hyperplasia, I might consider not radiating that patient. A patient with comorbidities where there is a reason to be concerned about pulmonary or cardiac dosing of radiation. So I think our default is to radiate DCIS, and certainly the majority of our patients overwhelmingly get radiated. But there's clearly room for judgment here.
Continuing the theme of DCIS, how are you approaching patients in terms of tamoxifen and endocrine therapy for DCIS?
We have viewed tamoxifen as a highly appropriate option for patients with DCIS since the NSABP B24 trial. It has not been accepted by our New York patients. When we sit down and do the math with them and look at risks and benefits and look at quality of life issues, it has been very common for them to demur from the tamoxifen. And so we probably have one of the lowest rates in the country of DCIS patients on tamoxifen. And whether there's some physician bias in that or not, or whether this is just a proactive patient population. The same can be said, by the way, in our prophylactic setting, where we've just not been successful in getting patients onto tamoxifen.
What are the biggest concerns about tamoxifen in the patient and maybe the physician?
I think that the two obvious ones are the fear of endometrial cancer and the fear of thromboembolic events. And even when we provide the raw numbers on how infrequent those events are, I think that since we are talking about minimal, if any, impact on long-term survivorship and moderate impact on local control issues, it simply is not an attractive option.
In a patient who is interested in taking tamoxifen, a postmenopausal patient who finds it intolerable because of side effects, will you offer an aromatase inhibitor?
Well, we'd like more information about DCIS and AIs, but I have to tell you that since ATAC's initial publication, aromatase inhibitors have certainly become our endocrine therapy of choice in postmenopausal ER-positive invasive cancers. And that literally happened overnight, and it happened like gangbusters. And so I think it is completely natural that there would be bleed over into the person who comes in who's postmenopausal with DCIS. And so I'm sure we've given AIs to some patients with DCIS.
You talked before about the fact that the patients and maybe the physicians are sort of not too excited about giving tamoxifen or DCIS. What about an AI?
In the setting of DCIS?
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely a conversation that we are having more frequently now, particularly if the principal concern is endometrial cancer, cataract formation, the other quality of life things that have been associated with tamoxifen. We're anxiously awaiting some trial data with DCIS and with prevention with the AIs, but they have so overwhelmingly transformed in our practice that I know there's bleed over into the DCIS patients.
What do you see as the future of AIs in the prevention and really DCIS setting, assuming it plays out the way we think it's going to play out, a little bit better anti-tumor effect, different toxicity profile? You pointed out, and you were one of the first to point out, I think, that tamoxifen hasn't really sat too well with people, as you just reviewed again. Assuming the AI clinical research data plays out the way we think it will, how do you think it's going to be accepted?
We're all eagerly anticipating the unblinding of STAR. There's no question that the winner, if you'll pardon the expression, of STAR will be compared to an aromatase inhibitor in a head-to-head trial. If raloxifen is found to have a vastly kinder, gentler toxicity profile than tamoxifen, then I think you'll have a real horse race on your hands with the AIs. In my clinical practice right now, there's no question that the AIs are vastly better tolerated than tamoxifen was in the postmenopausal patients. Our surgeons, by the way, are beginning to give first-line endocrine therapy without a mandatory consult from medical oncology. This was a policy change at Memorial a few years ago where our oncologists were really overwhelmed by the volume of invasive carcinomas. And the surgeons took a frontline role, and we get bone density tests on our patients before we start AIs. And that's been very satisfying.
Yeah, it's been interesting. Surgeons, particularly breast surgeons, used to write for tamoxifen routinely. And when the AI started to show the favorable data, I saw a definite hesitation for a while in terms of writing for them. But I guess you're saying that's now changing.
I think it's definitely changing. I think that once surgeons get comfortable with these drugs, tamoxifen has a 40-year head start, so surgeons are sometimes slow to change. But we've done a growing number of cases of neoadjuvant aromatase inhibitors in older patients with larger tumors that are ER positive with really some striking results. And not only can you downsize and downstage the majority of these patients, which leads to a far smaller surgical procedure, there are cases where the tumors go away completely and you are left with someone that you're following very closely. So aromatase inhibitors belong in a breast surgeon's practice and in a breast surgeon's armamentarium.
You mentioned the use of neoadjuvant AIs. Is this in a trial setting or are you also using it off-study?
Both. We were impressed by the initial work that Mike Dixon published from the UK and did our own in-house small study and really corroborated his findings exactly, both in terms of tumor response rates and patient acceptance.
So have you actually been using this as a way to downstage people the way Mike has, to try
Yes.
to get them to lumpectomy?
Absolutely. Certainly in the older patient population, we've done that. I would qualify it by saying it's not so much to convert that mastectomy patient to a lumpectomy patient as much as to downstage the disease.
Interesting. Another innovation in terms of, at least at this point, ER-positive patients, no negative specifically, has been the Oncotype DX assay. Can you review sort of what your take is on that and what do you think it means clinically?
Yeah, we're very excited about the possibilities of a truly genomic approach to the disease. And where we use the Oncotype DX are in the borderline cases where a low recurrence score would really preclude you from giving cytotoxic chemotherapy. And we've been very enthusiastic in that application. In the patient who either has a larger tumor or a higher grade tumor, or there are other mitigating factors, we're certainly not using the Oncotype DX as a sole factor in precluding people from cytotoxic chemo. But boy, in those borderline cases, it's been enormously helpful.
Is there any patient in your practice that you could present where, you know, the Oncotype really was helpful?
A wife of a Nobel laureate, educated, proactive woman with a 9-millimeter ER-positive, node-negative breast cancer.
HER2-negative, I assume.
HER2-negative. No worrisome features in the tumor, no LVI. She's on that 1-centimeter cusp, where if the pathologist had said 1.1 centimeter, it's likely at Memorial she would have bought chemo. We send off the specimen to Genomic Health, and it comes back with a very, very low recurrence score. She steps away from chemotherapy with a clear conscience. She goes on an aromatase inhibitor and is spared 4 months of, at our place, what would be dose-dense Adriamycin and Taxane.
How's she doing on the AI?
Great. No problems whatsoever.
Any case that you could pick out where it led to the patient getting chemotherapy?
Similar patient, similar clinical presentation, except a higher grade invasive cancer. Again, right on the 1-centimeter cusp. A question of lymphovascular invasion, although the pathologist wasn't willing to call that. Negative nodes both on H&E and IHC, HER2 negative, where the recurrence score came back astronomically high, and the patient went into the chemotherapy with a clear conscience that she was doing the right thing.
How old was that woman?
57.
And what were her thoughts about chemotherapy?
Well, it's very often the case. She had seen a neighbor of hers go through a terrible bout with chemo with 2 hospitalizations for neutropenic sepsis. Really a battle, a true battle. And so she had a kind of horrific view of chemotherapy in her mind and was really looking for a way to avoid it, which we weren't able to do.
I guess the thing that's really reassuring about that is not only do we know that a high score connotes a high risk or higher risk. But the fascinating thing about it was that those patients experienced so much benefit from chemotherapy, and, you know, in this case it was CMF or MDF, the older kind of chemotherapy, but yet you're looking at a 75% reduction of relapse, right?
Right. And what's stunning about these two cases, if you put them side by side and you run the adjuvant online Peter Rabdin software, they both came up with exactly the same 4% benefit from chemotherapy. And yet when you get the genomic health information, they couldn't have been farther apart.
I guess the other thing that people have talked about is the cost. I believe at this point Medicare is paying for it. And I think a lot of that is tied into the fact that it looks like it's cost effective. And I think your two cases sort of point that out.
I also think that if we nationalize our thoughts a little bit about the finances of this, and we actually did eliminate chemotherapy in a third of small node-negative breast cancers, and the estimates could be higher than a third, then this would look like the best money ever spent on a medical test.
Well, the other side, I know Gary Lyman has done a financial cost analysis of this, but he didn't bring in the fact that you're decreasing the costs by decreasing recurrence rates in people who otherwise might not have gotten chemotherapy. Your lady with a subcentimeter tumor very well might not have gotten chemotherapy, relapsed, and, you know, of course, the expense there, not that right. It's the most important thing, but it's very, very high, and you've eliminated 3/4 of that.
This is the tip of a slow-moving but a moving iceberg. I think that beginning to evaluate this technology in the low node count, node-positive subset is going to be useful, larger patient tumors. A study that we're very close to completing is a single nucleotide polymorphism chip profiling, SNP chip profiling in Ashkenazi Jewish women with remarkable family histories for breast and ovarian cancer who are BRCA1 and 2 negative. And so we've actually SNP chip profiled 300 Ashkenazi Jewish women with no history versus those with this remarkable history who are BRCA negative. And we are very optimistic, not that we'll find BRCA3, I happen to not believe BRCA3 is out there, but that there will be a similar type of panel of polymorphisms that will predispose to breast cancer. Remember that it's unlikely that all American women are actually at a 10% risk for developing breast cancer. It's far more likely that 30% of American women are at 30% risk. So if we can start subsetting not only the patients who are going to get breast cancer, but then subsetting those who get breast cancer, our therapies are going to be more directed and more specific and much smarter. And we'll look back at the day when every woman with a 1 centimeter node negative breast cancer got CMF or ACT, and we'll roll our eyes. We'll be very critical of ourselves.
What kind of chemotherapy did your second patient receive?
The Memorial standard is dose dense AC followed by T.
That's what you got?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Aggressive.
You mentioned sentinel node before. Anything new that's come out in the last year or so in that?
I would say that sentinel node has been integrated into clinical practice faster than any surgical technique in breast cancer in history. From the time of our first IRB protocol, we were accepting it as care in about 3 years. This is not because we're so good at it, frankly. It's because the anatomy is absolutely constant and predictable. The breast, as a unit, drains to common nodes. This includes the skin of the breast, the nipple, all quadrants, so that whether you're using tracer or blue dye or both, or intradermal or parenchymal injection, you're going to find the correct node. So that we've now done just under 9,000 sentinel node procedures. The questions that remain are DCIS. Are we justified in doing a sentinel node in DCIS? And the answer there is no, except that we don't often know that it's just DCIS. So in patients with palpable masses that come back DCIS, we know there's a chance for invasion. A spiculated mass that's read out as DCIS, or a breast that's filled with DCIS, we will do a sentinel node in those patients. That's about 15% of our total practice. And 10% of those are positive, so a 1.5% overall node positivity rate, which we think is very much in line with what we understand biologically about DCIS. We've moved away from doing sentinel node biopsies in prophylactic mastectomies. A colleague of mine named Terry King did a prospective study of 160 consecutive prophylactic mastectomies in which she did a sentinel node. And at the end of the day, the sentinel node made a difference in one out of 160 cases. So we are not routinely doing that. Probably the strongest debate exists in whether we should trust a sentinel lymph node after induction cytotoxic chemotherapy. And this is an interesting story because the groups that have looked at it have all concluded that there's a 12% false negative rate after chemo. Some of the groups conclude that's a low false negative rate, and some of the groups conclude that's a very high false negative rate. And we happen to fall into the latter, so that we are doing things such as axillary ultrasound prior to chemotherapy to see if we can identify the node positive patients, or we're actually doing the sentinel node prior to the chemotherapy. But as a practice standard, we're not accepting a negative sentinel node after a run of induction chemo.
This concludes the second CD. For more from the interview with Dr. Borgen, please turn to the third CD.
What about the issue of axillary dissection after a positive sentinel node? It seems like we're not going to have a clinical research answer to that because the Z11 trial closed. Are there situations where you think it's reasonable to not do an axillary section in that situation?
Yes. Kim Van Zee, one of my partners, created a nomogram that will very accurately predict the likelihood of finding a positive node in the axilla above a positive sentinel node. This is available free on our website, which is mskcc.org. And that's an incredibly useful tool because if I've got someone and the score is 2% or 3% of me finding more disease, I'll forego the axillary dissection. 20%, 30%, I won't. So I do think that there's selectivity in who gets an axillary dissection. There is a trial about to commence, led by Barbara Smith and her colleagues in Boston, which will randomize sentinel node positive patients to axillary surgery versus axillary radiation. And that's going to be an incredibly valuable and exciting study.
Seems like that'd have to be one hell of a large study to find an answer.
It will. And a long time, as we discussed before.
This nomogram, what are the key factors that are incorporated into it?
What Dr. Van Zee did was she looked back at 1,000 consecutive node positive, sentinel node positive patients, and using a logistic regression model, identified the variables that were associated with node positivity above a sentinel node, so that what you would predict, tumor size, tumor grade, the presence of lymphovascular invasion, ductal versus lobular, the number of nodes you take out, whether you took out one sentinel node or four sentinel nodes. And then finally, it relies on how was the metastasis detected? Was it H&E or was it IHC? And those factors together were weighted by the model so that what you get is a clean percentage score of the chance of finding a positive node.
You mentioned number of sentinel nodes. What's the typical number you guys get? What should it be? And what are the variables?
Well, after 8,000 plus cases, we have a remarkably constant number of sentinel nodes per person, which is about 2.5 sentinel nodes per patient. The range there is 1 to about 7 or 8. Beyond 7 sentinel lymph nodes, that's a failed procedure. Your tracer has either fragmented and gone to too many axillary lymph nodes, or there's some other anatomic reason that it has failed. A recent change in our practice that is noteworthy is we learned that if one selects the hottest or the largest or the bluest sentinel nodes, the first three nodes contain breast cancer when it's there, about 97% of the time. So we are only doing enhanced pathology on the first three sentinel nodes. So on that case where there's five or six sentinel nodes, the other nodes go for routine analysis.
What about internal mammary sentinel nodes?
We seem to talk about it more than we do it. The patient who I think would benefit from an internal mammary node biopsy would be a younger patient with a sub-centimeter inner quadrant cancer in whom the axilla is negative, where the internal mammary node being positive would buy them chemotherapy. Now, Oncotype DX may make that argument obsolete. That rare scenario represents 2 to 3% of our entire practice, so it's a very, very uncommon scenario. It is worth noting for the surgeons that many surgeons in America are using the intradermal injection approach that we championed, the skin never drains to the internal mammary nodes. And so if one is seeking information about an internal mammary node, you have to do a deep parenchymal injection.
What about the issue of false negative in sentinel node? What has been seen nationally, and what do you tell your patients about your own false negative rate?
Well, there are two scenarios, and they're worth separating. When we look at our prophylactic mastectomy patient population who had a sentinel node, a third of the 160 patients had instrumentation of the breast within 3 months of their prophylactic surgery. All were benign. There wasn't a single IHC-positive cell in any of those cases. However, when Chip Cody looked at instrumentation of cancers with either FNAs or core biopsies, he did find and report a higher rate of IHC-positive cells in these sentinel nodes. Now, the difference wasn't striking. It was 1% versus 3%. But there's no question that some of these cells that we see on IHC could be artifactual. Last year at ASCO, we presented a retrospective study where we went to archives from Memorial Hospital and identified 400 patients from 1976 and 1977 in whom we had all the lymph node material available. These were cases that were signed out as node negative. After doing enhanced pathology on all the nodes from all of the cases, we would reclassify 20% of these patients as node positive. And when we looked at the survival data, IHC H&E negative patients had a worse relapse-free survival and breast cancer-specific survival. So in the main, I would argue that IHC positivity is meaningful. Yes, there's a small chance of false positivity, but I don't think that it's in a biologically irrelevant event.
What about the false negative rate of sentinel node?
Last year at the American Surgical, we presented a 5-year follow-up on almost 4,000 sentinel node cases, and our clinical false negative rate was about half of 1%, which is right in line with a published series of full axillary clearance, you know, aggressive axillary treatment. So I think that what you really care about is the subset of patients who come back with a positive node in their axilla after a negative sentinel node, and that's less than 1%, which, again, I think is in line with almost any medical intervention that we have.
What about the false negative in terms of, you know, for example, whether the NSABP looked at it comparing sentinel node to sentinel node followed by axillary dissection, and I'm sure your test cases, you looked at the same thing.
We were concerned by the high false negative rate reported by the NSABP.
It was about 10%.
It was about 10%. And we certainly, in the first 500 cases, all of our sentinel node procedures were done by two surgeons, myself and Chip Cody. And after really mastering the technique, we had a 2 to 3% false negative rate when you completed the axillary dissection. We've known for a long time from randomized trials such as the B04, where there was a randomization from radical mastectomy versus total mastectomy with and without radiation therapy. If you look at the node positivity rate in that trial in the radical mastectomy arm, it was about 40%. But in the total mastectomy group who didn't have nodes removed, only 20% of them presented with clinically positive nodes. The reason for this has never been entirely clear. But that's what we now see clinically, where we know that the false negative rate may actually be 1% or 2%, but we're seeing less than 1% of clinical recurrences.
Why do you think the NSABP saw a 10% rate?
I think that one of the beauties of a large-scale randomized clinical trial is also one of the Achilles' heels, and that is you have a bell curve of surgeons who are high volume and low volume, who are from institutions that are high volume and low volume. I think that in general, randomized trials make bad surgeons look good and good surgeons look bad.